All right, well, welcome everyone to this very big room. My name is Jan Vernick, and the session is called Gun Violence Risk Reduction, a Legal and Policy Approach. And I'm just so happy that this session is sponsored by the law section, the recently elevated to section status law section here at APHA. And I'm hoping that it's just the first in a long line of sessions that the law section devotes to injury and violence prevention. If I know that anything I say about moving your seats is going to be futile, but I'll say it anyway. If you would feel in this large room like moving forward, if the spirit of community moves you, and in fact it really moves you, and you want to move forward, that would be great. If not, don't worry about it. Well, you can slink out if that was your intention all along. I am the moderator of the session, Jan Vernick. I'm an associate professor at Johns Hopkins, and I co-direct the Center for Gun Policy and Research, and also the Center for Law and the Public's Health. In addition to moderating, I'm making the first presentation, and then I'll introduce each of our subsequent speakers in turn. We're aiming to leave lots of time at the end for questions, so we'll ask you to hold your questions till the end, if you don't mind. The purpose of the session is there are a number of sessions here at APHA on firearm violence and prevention, but the theme here, not surprisingly, is law, law and policy, law and policy approaches. And you'll see that the sessions are devoted to law and policy approaches addressing gun dealers, as I'll be talking about in a moment, gun manufacturers, gun sellers and buyers, and then domestic abusers. And we have just some of the leading folks in the country here, and so you brilliantly chose this session rather than finishing your lunch somewhere or wherever else. Okay, so let me start the first session, and I'll ask Daniel to keep time for me, if you wouldn't mind. So I'm going to talk about law and litigation addressing licensed gun dealers, and this is the mandatory. It always seems a little sad to me. I have no relationships to disclose, but okay. Firearm dealers, I'm going to give you some background and talk a little bit about federal and state legal regulation of gun dealers. If you're, quote, engaged in the business of selling guns, if that's your job, if that's how you make livelihood and profit, you're required to have a federal firearms license to be an FFL. There are about 60,000 such licensed gun dealers in the U.S. That includes pawnbrokers who sell guns regularly, but it doesn't include private individuals who just make an occasional sale of guns. This is going to come up again later on, or who are part of a collection. Why is it important whether you're an FFL or not? If I'm purchasing a gun from a federal firearms licensee, that is, think of it as a gun store, a background check has to be conducted when a sale is made. That's not true if I'm buying from a private person in most U.S. states, at least not under federal law. FFLs can buy guns interstate, which non-FFLs cannot do, and from other licensees without a background check. And it's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives that has oversight over FFLs. So I'm going to tell the story of law and regulation of gun dealers as sort of a bad news, good news story, okay? So let's start with the bad news, the bad news. This is a quote from John Riggio of Chuck's Gun Shop, which is just outside of Chicago. When someone walks in the door, all they have to have is a heartbeat, and it's showtime. It's time to sell. It suggests that it's not a dealer who's being terribly discriminatory about who or discriminating about who they're ultimately going to sell to. This is a picture that I think April Zioli, who's in the audience here, took for me of a gun store in Virginia, no permit required. Well, yes, Virginia is one of those states, and Daniel Webster will talk about permit to purchase licensing systems. Yes, there is, in fact, no permit required in Virginia, but maybe you would agree with me that this sign is sending some subtler message about the degree of oversight this dealer is likely to be engaging in when you walk in the door. So there are problem gun dealers. There are gun dealers who are facilitating illegal sales. Most guns that are traced to crime, actually nearly all, were first sold by a licensed dealer. It's sort of a truism that that other than guns that are stolen directly from dealers or distributors or manufacturers are basically first sold by a licensed dealer. So doing something at the dealer level has an enormous potential for benefit or success. In ATF trafficking investigations, scofflaw dealers account for more guns than any other source, and the handful of gun dealers, as I'll show you later on, that are disproportionately responsible for crime guns, those aren't just the large sales volume dealers or those that are in dangerous locations. There's also survey research that again suggests that there are some problem dealers out there, maybe more than we would think. In a survey that Susan Sorensen, who's here, and Kate Vittes did some years ago, about half of the dealers were willing to make a sale under conditions of questionable legality, basically a straw purchase, a person who is lawful to buy a gun, saying, well, I want to buy the gun from my boyfriend, essentially. And about half of the dealers said, yes, that would be okay. In California, which does regulate dealers somewhat more carefully, we'll talk about that in a second, about a fifth of the dealers were willing to make a straw sale. And dealers report in surveys that straw purchase attempts are common, that it's very common for people to come in and not be the person for whom the gun is actually intended, but the lawful buyer who wants to buy it for the person who's otherwise not permitted to have the gun. Two-thirds of dealers report a straw purchase attempt. Again, remember, this is the bad news part of the story. Federal law in 1986 actually made it harder to engage in effective dealer regulation and oversight. It raised the standard of proof that's required to convict a gun dealer of breaking the law to a willful violation. Since this is the law section, many of you will know that's a much higher burden of proof than is ordinarily required for a criminal conviction. The 86 Act also permitted a maximum of one routine compliance inspection of dealers per year, and given the resources that ATF has, in fact, most dealers are not inspected anywhere approaching once per year. It's much more infrequent. Record-keeping violations by dealers are only a misdemeanor, that is not a serious offense, and the FOPA made it harder to revoke a dealer's license. Again, more bad news. In 2005, Congress enacted and President Bush signed the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. You know that a law sailed through when it doesn't even need a catchy acronym, the PLCAA, you can't even say anything out of that. It gave gun dealers and manufacturers very broad immunity from most kinds of litigation. Lawsuits had been filed in an effort to pressure dealers to engage in safer business practices. There are some exceptions, and we can talk about that as well. It retroactively caused the dismissal of most litigation against the gun industry, and therefore one, I think, can safely argue that it dramatically eroded the potential public health function of lawsuits. The public health function of lawsuits, as I hope is obvious, is to provide manufacturers and dealers, in this case, an economic incentive to engage in safer business practices. So that's the sort of federal landscape. States are permitted to do better. There is no preemption of gun laws at the state level, as many other public health problems face. That's at least one problem we don't face. There's no preemption. So a few years ago, we did a project where we tried to identify additional state laws that might provide greater oversight of gun dealers. And the linchpin, I would argue, of that set of laws is the first one, dealer licensing. Because if states license a dealer, not just the federal license, which I've already mentioned, that gives the states leverage over the gun dealers. If the gun dealer engages in some bad act, they don't have to wait for the under-resourced Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to do something. They can do it themselves. They can yank the gun dealer's license and put them out of business. So you'll see the other kinds of state gun laws related to dealers that we looked at. So let me show you what we found. But you didn't think this presentation would be about cosmetology, did you? How many states license professional haircut of the person who cuts your hair when you go? How many? All of them, right? So all in green states. These are states which require a license for professional haircutters. How many states license gun dealers under state law? The answer is 17, and the District of Columbia. 17, again, compared to 50 for cosmetologists. So a remarkable thing, especially again if states want to have some leverage over gun dealers. Here are the number of states that we identified with these various policies. I'll call your attention in particular to number 5. Just 2 states mandated an annual compliance inspection to make sure that the dealer could account for their inventory, that the dealer wasn't selling guns off the books or out the back door to impermissible buyers. Just 2. And frankly, even only 23 states even permitted a regular inspection without there being some criminal law investigation associated with it. Okay. That was the bad news. So here's the potentially good news. The first bullet says that this was somewhat older data, but I bet you that it's still essentially correct. About 1% of licensed gun dealers are responsible for more than half of the guns traced to crime. Why is that good news? I ask my students the same question. Well, it's good news because it means that there's just a small number of gun dealers that are responsible for an enormous share of the crime guns, so that if we can focus on just a relatively modest slice of the deal, what's 1%, 600 dealers nationwide? So a dozen, roughly, obviously varies from state to state, but a dozen or so, you can think of it, dealers per state. We have the potential to really focus enforcement resources and make a big difference on guns traced to crime. And the kinds of things that we've looked at Johns Hopkins include undercover stings of gun dealers and state licensing, which I've already mentioned, and inspection of dealers. So 3 cities in the Midwest, Chicago, Detroit, and Gary, Indiana, conducted undercover stings of dealers in the late 90s. The sort of magnitude of the intervention varied a little bit from place to place. But in research that Daniel Webster led, we saw big declines in trafficked guns that were sold in the state by all gun dealers, not just the dealers that were stung. You sent a message that law enforcement cares, that law enforcement is looking at you, that if you're engaged in dangerous sales practices, you can't do it with no risk whatsoever under dark of night, etc. So we saw a big decline in Chicago, still a pretty big decline in Detroit, and in Gary, where the Indiana, where the intervention was less substantial, we ultimately saw no significant change. But 2 out of 3 cities, pretty big effects. How about state licensing and inspection of gun dealers? Well, again, in research that Daniel Webster and I conducted, we saw that that cities that were in states that had strong dealer regulation and oversight, and you can see what counted as strong dealer regulation and oversight, had much lower levels of a measure of intrastate gun trafficking. We counted something as a trafficked gun if it was recovered from the police within a year of its first lawful sale, so within a short time to crime, essentially, and where the seller was not the same person, the buyer was not the same person as the person from whom it was recovered, so it had changed hands quickly and been used in crime quickly. So so strong dealer regulation and oversight is feasible. State or local license, record-keeping rules, mandating or permitting inspections. Importantly, we actually did a survey to assess whether regular inspections were not just permitted, but were in fact being conducted, how the law was being implemented. So I'm going to try to set a model for staying on time here and conclude by saying that again, this was a bad news, good news story, but I think the good news is pretty substantial good news. Better regulation of dealers is feasible. Among those states, a handful of states that had dealer licensing included some of what you might call red states, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama. It wasn't entirely concentrated among blue, liberal, northeastern, and western states. So it's possible to do that. Maryland, in fact, changed its law in 2013. Maryland is one of those obviously blue states, but making it easier to punish violations. And for those who say, well, what about the Second Amendment to the Constitution, the business about the right to keep and bear arms that the Supreme Court in 2008 in the case issued to Columbia against Heller said for the first time was an individual right. Well, at the same time, they also said that gun sales laws and things like dealer regulation are presumptively lawful. And that ought not to be terribly surprising because licensing dealers and doing a better job of inspecting them isn't the kind of thing that ought to make law-abiding gun owners nervous, doesn't affect the ability of law-abiding people to purchase and own guns. So I'm optimistic about a future where we can do a better job, among other approaches to gun violence prevention, of regulating gun dealers. Okay, well, that's my session. Thank you very much.